Hello and welcome to This Is Property with John Pidgeon going solo today. A special guest on the show has many, many years' experience both in residential property investing as well as commercial property, which is now his focus today. He runs a buyer's agent company for commercial property around the country. He's an author. The name of the book, Rethink Property Investing. I might have given it away, but welcome to the show, Scott O'Neill.
Good to be here, John. Thanks for having me, mate.
No problems at all. So keen to delve into this space today because there are a lot of questions that come across our table in respect to commercial and the intrigue around it. So, we won't steal the show, but we'll get ourselves started.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Okay, so before we delve into what's happening today, you're a successful author, you run a successful buyer's agent service around the country. Talk to us about your life growing up, I suppose, and even before real estate entered the conversation.
Yeah, well, going right back to the start, born in Sydney, went to school down in the Shire, then later went into the Newington College thing in high school, and always was pretty good at mathematics. That was kind of my thing at school, not so much English. So we battled through those subjects, but focused on the other ones. And basically I went into civil engineering, Sydney Uni, and that's kind of where I got my first real job. I did McDonald's and worked in car yards and did all sorts of things prior to that. But basically it ended up getting a job for Leighton Contractors back in the day and did that for a few years. It was really hard work. Like I was literally on the rail ballast building railways with the team there. And I think I've still got my name signed off on certain segments of railway that, so if there's a derailment down there one day, I might get called up. Hopefully not. But that's the type of risk you have to deal with as an engineer. And I think in the background, when I started working, I realized it was, it's your whole life, and it was a significant commitment to the point where I was like, I needed to work on a plan B because I wasn't loving the job, and that's where property crept in as a subject matter that I was interested in. And I saw my parents dabble into it, and they were kind of the, dad's an accountant background, so very like negatively geared focus. That was all the rage back then in the 90s and the early 2000s. It was easier to do them when, prices were 400K for a house in Sydney. Like, so it's obviously a bit different now, but I guess that's where I sort of wanted to invest a little bit differently because we were the typical, I wouldn't call us asset rich family, but we were asset well off and cash poor. And that was the scenario that I kind of didn't want to replicate myself because I wanted to have the best of both worlds, I guess, travel and not just work and work and work and then, invest. And then maybe when you're 50 or 60, you can get off that train. But I basically started looking at properties. It was just after the GFC. So I think that negativity around how bad property markets were going over in the US, I read a lot. I'd read all the forums, to the 50th page and understand everyone's opinions. Because I was very fear driven when I was investing my first life savings into a property. And that's where I found, a house and granny flat in Sydney. And that positively geared, strategy was kind of accidentally found because it was a $660 a week rent on a $480,000 purchase. And that was with no strata, lower interest rates. There were good numbers on it.
You'd argue that house and granny flat was pretty unique back then. It wasn't that common, right?
Yeah, and that's why I said it was a total accident. We were looking at units, and this is to live in as well. And, I remember it was a unit in Miranda or a house in Sutherland. That was the choice. And I looked back a couple of years ago at the difference in price between the house versus the unit, and you know that was a 400K decision in growth, just that plus the cash flow, which was probably, you know, I haven't added that up, but it would have been significant because that was 15 years ago now, almost, or 14 years ago. So, yeah, it shows how that first decision on a property makes such a major impact to your wealth.
Yeah, absolutely. So that kickstarted. But going back a step, talking about your parents and that negative gearing, which you mentioned was quite common, and we lived through that ourselves as well, you came to the realization that, okay, this doesn't make sense to me. I want some positive cash flow in my life. I don't want to be losing money. Did mum and dad come to that realization? Did they own it, or did they say, hang on, son, if you're going to do it this other way?
Oh, look, good question. It's almost one we've never really discussed. I know, later in life they got into like the unit blocks, which I was purchasing, but yeah, not really the commercial side of things, which that was, I guess they viewed it as more too risky. You know, I guess that, you know, that's one of the kind of big things we discuss with our clients, you know, the risk versus reward with commercial, like, because if you get commercial wrong, you get punished harder. That's the reality, but you will make better returns. And yeah, look, they were at a different stage of life where, you know, they didn't want to learn about a new asset class and all that stuff. So, you know, they stuck down that route, and, you know, they're, again, different strategies. They're just more paying debt down, and you know, that's them done type of thing from a finance point of view.
Yeah, sure. So from the research that I've done, you spent about 5 or 6 years in the resi space as a residential investor before you said, hang on a minute, I'm going over the road, I'm changing from Collingwood to Carlton, and I'm going to go to commercial. How far into a portfolio were you, and what made you change?
So I was about 15 properties in for residential. So I guess there was two things that made me change. One was just the realization that the cash flow, especially with these, the amount of properties I was buying and the debt I was acquiring, like I was making great money through, you know, equity and that. But it clearly showed I wasn't going to retire from this. The income was just not efficient. Like, so there is income there, but like you're getting, like I was targeting high yielding real estate too in residential. You know, I'm talking 6%, 7%, 8% gross returns. But by the time you take all the outgoings and, you know, I was literally feeling I was spending thousands a month or even a week on maintenance as well. Like it all creeps into the spreadsheets.
Yeah.
The reality was the returns are not as good as anyone says. Yeah, and once you take out that. So I'm a big believer residential property is where you start. You leverage as much as you safely can and do that for a while. But, you know, when I realized that, you know, with the numbers I was getting, I needed to change the strategy because the banks even told me, you're running out of serviceability. And that was kind of the nail in the coffin that said, this strategy is now dead for me. I've needed to mix it up. And it was either like people get to this crossroads more often than you think. You'd know with your business, John, that there's a lot of people that acquire a lot of residential properties and then the banks start making life more difficult. And you can only really keep going if you can boost your income somehow or pay debts down. And you know, paying debts down generally means you're not acquiring new properties. And if you're boosting your income, it's really from your job or a business that you can kind of fuel it. But if you want to replace your income, this is where commercial property, not only with the spreadsheets proving that the banks also back this up and they lend easier into commercial property as well.
So your long-term goal or outcome was to replace your working income. So the 40 hours a week, the trading time for money, your sole objective through property was to replace income. Is that fair to say?
That's right. And I kind of realized like a lot of these high-yielding investments in commercial, they came with great capital growth as well. Like the growth was significant. Like, you know, I remember I bought a little industrial unit in Newcastle and I actually bought and sold that within 13 months. And the reason I sold it is I bought a PPOR in Sydney. I wish I didn't sell that house, but industrial unit, but it grew about 25% in 1 year.
Yeah,
so, and that was kind of my first experience of like, these things are growing, but you know, if you listen to the myths, commercial doesn't grow as much as residential. And I'm thinking, well, the houses didn't grow that much. I didn't buy it particularly well. There was no fancy business with a lease or anything. It was just a tightening market. And I saw it, and then I got all my other commercial properties revalued, and the numbers were fantastic. And that's where I was just fully hooked. I was like, I'm getting better cash flow. The growth is there as well. I can recycle that equity if I need to. It felt like a real business then, because the portfolio was producing significant income. You could do things with it. You could expand the portfolio. You could refinance to get better interest rates or less leverage on other assets. Like, it felt like there was more options that I didn't have when I was purely residential.
Sure. So again, I'm going to backtrack because there's a lot of questions running through my mind, but 15 properties in 6 years by the sounds of things. So for someone that was quite low risk, that was doing a lot of research around it, I would call that pretty aggressive. Was there a time where you thought, maybe if I bought four or five more expensive assets that were more negatively geared or less cash flow, that we may have produced a better result?
Yeah, look, good question, John. It's really, I guess when the low risk section was, I guess when I was looking after, like, because I had that idea the GFC was going to wipe us out. And look, it only costs us, like, it was less than 10% falls in Sydney, you may remember. And
yes,
most of that growth was caught up within a year as well. So not much of a crash in the end. But I always invested into the types of properties that I thought would do well in that worst case recession. So I was buying entry level, you know, freehold type properties that would collect the bottom end of the market in terms of rent. And often it was multi-tenant. So how I bought so many properties so quickly was creating equity through strata title subdivisions in mostly regional New South Wales, a few or two unit blocks in the Gold Coast. But I'd do the paperwork, change the usage on it or change the ownership on it and revalue it. And that would create equity. And I saw it very low risk because I was buying six packs of units, which, you know, well under what it would take cost to buy six individual units. So there'd be a margin, you know, 20 plus percent. And then that could kind of leapfrog you into the next deal. And it was positively geared because back then not many people were targeting unit blocks outside of random SMSF purchases. And I was doing a lot of it off market through letterbox dropping and stuff like that. So I was putting time and effort into it. Like, I was, it was a serious hobby or part-time job call. Yeah. So I wasn't just sitting on realestate.com and collecting a property here or there. Like, there was hours getting put into it.
Which is what needs to be done, right? If you're going to treat something seriously and go and do it yourself and get your hands dirty, you need to put the hours in like a part-time job, don't you?
Yeah. And even to the point where, like, you would really manage trades and, like, properly. Like, I wouldn't just do it through property managers and accept their first or second quote. Like, often I'd do the work myself. Like, you know, I've renovated about three or four properties and really basic stuff. I'm not a tradesman, but you can sand floors, you can paint properties, and that at times when I just completed a purchase, when I was down to the last $5,000 into my bank account, like, those types of things saved the job. And then once you get the property re-rented, you'd get, you know, an extra $50 to $100 of rent in some cases, and then you can go back to the bank. And, like, it literally was a lot of short-term pain for long-term gain.
So that was 10 to 15 years ago. Obviously, since then, property prices have headed north in a major way. Do you think that strategy, if you were to go and do that again, could be replicated just in smaller markets or smaller regional locations?
Look, I don't think the unit block strategy works as well. Like, a lot of people have asked me to find recent ones, and, you know, the odd property might come up once a month Australia-wide that's worth purchasing. Like, we look for them. But like you said, they're in quite regional locations. Maybe the building isn't at code to actually strata title. Like, there's no firewall protection and maybe not enough car spots, or, you know, you've got to put all the water meters in. Like, there's a lot of work you've got to do, and then the margin may be less than 10%. So you then ask, is it worth taking on that job? Because lending can be more difficult as soon as there's more than, like, three tenants on a title.
Yeah.
Because it's like, it can be a commercial loan or even worse than a commercial loan in some cases. So it's harder. I definitely think I bought a lot of, like, you know, four-bedroom houses in, you know, those kind of middle ring suburbs and that. And you can definitely replicate that strategy now. I'm seeing some amazing results in places like Perth and Brisbane and those who got into Adelaide a couple of years ago. Like, you know, Perth, if you look at CoreLogic, the last 12 months it grew, I believe it was 19.6 or 19.8%. Mm. So
yes.
Anyone that bought a 500 grand house there is laughing, you know. Yeah. So that's as good a return as I ever would have got. And, you know, they didn't have to lift a shovel.
No, absolutely. So we're here to talk commercial and we're getting to it. So I suppose the transition came in 2015, was it?
Yes, 2015. They bought a fish and chip shop and a little supermarket and, yeah, that was the first taste of commercial.
Yeah, okay. And did you have anyone around you that said, Scott, commercial's the way to go? Or did you find this stuff out yourself? Did you have a team of people in your corner to be, because there's a lot of naysayers out there, aren't there? Like when you try and do something that's different to everyone else, you get shut down or in your best interests, they say, nah, don't do that. It's safer to do this. How was your experience to transition?
Yeah, look, 2015 was, there was nothing but naysayers, if I'm being honest. Like I never really had many people to talk about commercial property. Like there wasn't the industry there is now. Like, you know, buyer's agents are everywhere now. You know, back in 2015, there's probably less than 20 of them and no one knew what they were back then. But commercial was just not a topic to discuss, and especially Perth back then too, because you imagine that Perth was coming out of a serious rut at that point. And I remember I was actually traveling at the time and met some people from Perth and, you know, told him I was, yeah, looking at a supermarket and fish and chip. And I'd try to sell it. These are just randoms we're, like, traveling on a holiday with. And they were, you know, I was selling it to them. Go, oh, look, fish and chip shop, been there for 30 years. Surely that's recession-proof. It's a good deal. Supermarket, everyone's got to eat. You know, people are going to, you know, get their smokes and stuff from there and all that, because I knew the business made a lot of money through that at the time. And they just said, do not touch it with a barge pole. Commercial, you'll make no money. It's such a risky game. It never grows. Like, these are guys that, you know, new property, but, you know, I always remember that, because if I listened to them, I would have lost a lot of money, because that probably doubled in value. And at the time, it was about a 9% net yield too.
Wow.
So,
yeah.
You know, the interest rates were nowhere near that. And like, it was just, I think I, like, it was only a small purchase and I was getting $1,000 a week clear from the deal. So 50 grand pay rise for doing nothing other than buying a property. Like that just made all my other previous investors look weak. Investments rather. So the numbers sold it to me basically.
Mm. Awesome. Okay, we're going to take a break. And then when we come back, got some listener questions for you.
If you're after personal financial advice, don't get it from a podcast. If you would like help based on your own personal situation, head over to sortyourmoneyout.com, click get help, and we'd be happy to introduce you to one of our trusted advisors. We also have a panel of trusted mortgage brokers we can connect you with to get you into your first home, an investment property purchase, or to review your current loan if you don't have a broker. Our panel of advisors, mortgage brokers, and accountants work with clients all over Australia so they can connect with you wherever you are. That's sortyourmoneyout.com and click get help.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
All right, so a couple of listener questions for you, Scott. Lucy mentioned how much deposit is required to get a good, solid first property. Now, that's sort of an open-ended question that could go anyway, but, yep. What do you see out there at the minute?
Well, you can buy properties as cheap as 150 grand in commercial property, even less. You know, a car park can be considered commercial, and you can pick them up in Sydney for less than 50k. But I generally think around 600k is where an entry level price point is. That's not super risky, so that might be a small industrial unit. That's kind of a good starting place. You know, this is not financial advice, of course, but if you've got, you know, a 30% deposit on that one, on that 600K, then you've got to allow for your stamp duty and other purchasing costs like building and pest reports. You've got to pay for a valuation in commercial, which might be a grand and a half, $2,000, that type of number. I'd like to say 200K is a high level number to reach. You know, equity or cash, you can use it. And that would give you a capital city property. And you can get it less than that, but I think the key word is solid investment. That's where you want to start.
So you mentioned before that like commercial is something that you'd recommend you maybe delve into once you've got a start in residential space. But the 600K price point is not necessarily the barrier. What I'm hearing is the barrier is the actual deposit, the 30% down, and having the cash available to do that. Is that fair to say? Because a lot of residential property, you can, your entry level is also 400, 500, 600K.
That's right. Yeah. So as you know, with Resi, you can do 10% deposits, 15, 20. So, you know, you've effectively got to do a 30% deposit. And that, look, you can do less. Like there are some banks out there doing 20% loans, and you can actually do a 100% loan as well if you do a straight refinance from other assets. But for the purpose of this question, I guess we're assuming it's a first purchase. So yeah, cash at 30% down will give you access to all the banks, and that's what you want. You know, you don't want to go through some super risky high interest rate deal for your first. So yeah, 200K. Which is, you know, a lot more than what maybe an 80 grand starting point in residential would be. Yeah. So you need more than double the money.
Yeah, which not a lot of people have laying around, especially with the cost of living, etc. So for our listeners' sake, can you expand on maybe the different types of commercial? Because with residential, you've basically got a house, unit, townhouse, and different hybrid versions of that. In commercial, can you just explain the differences? I suppose, what are they and what are the differences in that? Because that sounds as though it's pretty key as to what investment type you take within the commercial sector.
Yeah, so super high level, I'll just go through all of them. So office space, and I'll give a quick, you know, thing on the market as well. So office space is historically been the, you know, the top class investment for the last 50 years, but that's done a complete U-turn in the last decade because work from home and COVID kind of put the nail in the coffin for confidence with CBD office space.
Just before you expand on that, I'm intrigued to know someone like yourself to answer. Was the office space dying, the work from home was starting to come in before COVID, or did COVID actually turn that for us?
I believe COVID changed that. Look, there was slight hints of it with a lot more of a tech startup type, you know, vibe heading our way, because a lot of the big corporations, they're just losing market share on total employment. Like if you look back at, you know, in the 1929, the reason why that crash was so bad for people is there was just some giant companies that employed everyone, like the entire towns made it, you know, like Ford and companies like that. So, you know, when those big companies lay off everyone at once and there's not many big companies to go down, that's where the employment situation can be a lot worse. But we're finding there's more smaller companies. You know, it's the beauty of the internet that's allowed smaller companies to do very well very quickly. And a lot of them don't need big floor plates in the office. So there was always a bit of a trend towards not needing that. But I think now there's, you don't necessarily need a big office to justify, you know, how great a company is. You know, it still helps. Like it gives confidence to, you know, if you're dealing with family offices and, you know, overseas investors and things like that, having a physical presence shows stability and gives confidence to people rather than working out of your spare room at home. But you don't need it. And that's kind of what COVID fast-tracked, I think. So now you would know, John, you don't meet face-to-face with clients often. It's done over the internet and the world still goes around.
Yeah, 100%. Okay, so office space was the theme pre-COVID. Post-COVID, obviously other options, but what's the flavour of the day?
So the weakness in COVID shifted a strength towards industrial. So think about everything you deal with in life that's manufactured and stored, and a lot of it kind of gets transported or originates from a shed, whether it's manufacturing or logistics. It's a big roof over storage is extremely valuable close to a city these days. So we've seen rapid capital growth rates. Rents are still growing at like 10 to 15% per annum in the industrial space. So, there's a lot of talk about a rental crisis in residential. They've kind of got the same thing with industrial. It's just no one talks about that because it's not an everyday man or woman's problem. So it's a very good place to be an investor, though. They're not building enough of it because build costs have gone up. Builders can't make margins as easy. So there's actually like a long-term problem of supply in this market. And look, no doubt growth will come, and then there'll be easier builder margins to be had. There'll be more supply on the market. But the main message there is like about 60% of our volume at Rethink is industrial. It's very popular from high net worth individuals all the way down to your first time commercial investor. It's a good place to park money up if the fundamentals of that specific market are right. The other asset class is retail. That's probably my personal favorite. It's one that I've invested in retail more than, from a dollar amount, more than any other asset class I own. I own a number of small shopping centers, with IGAs and childcares and medical centers in them. They're part of the community. That's why I like them. It's a forever investment that I feel.
You have your kids walk through the shopping center and say, Daddy owns this.
Yeah, they're not, no local ones yet, but
not local.
It's a goal one day because, a shed, I dare say I would have made more money investing in sheds in recent times, but I don't know. I just like this. I like the fact that it's part of the community. And I think a little bit more laterally as well, like when you look at the zoning of retail, it's quite rare. It might be surrounded by residential properties. Like think about your local store that might have a Foodworks or an IGA or a small Coles or Woolies in there. Like it's probably been a shopping center for 50 plus years. And there's, you've got your doctors, your dentist in there. You might have a pizza joint and that type of stuff in there. And, the tenants will come and go, but there's multiple tenants. So it's like an all-in-one portfolio. And I just think that zoning will become more valuable over the decades because the density of housing around that area should increase. Mm. It's a massive general comment, of course, but the density of those shopping centres will also increase. And that's why a lot of them turn into mixed use as well, where they start building units above them.
Yeah. Yeah. The density thing is spot on. Like it's where we can't build enough houses or dwellings at the rate that people are wanting to move to the country or living longer, those sort of things. I look at that and say, well, people don't have enough room to park their car or house their boat or their caravan or these lifestyle things that they get themselves into. So automatically my mind goes to storage sheds. Storage sheds half hour from the CBD where I roll along the freeway, I pick up my boat or my caravan and I go on holidays. Talk to us about that. Am I just living a pipe dream there?
Yeah, look, storage, I kind of put that in the industrial barrel to a degree. It's a little bit different because the good side of storage is you've got more tenants. The bad side is you're dealing with, for a super technical term, rats and mice tenants,
Yeah.
So you've basically got a lot of turnover and that can, you generally need a head business running it. So it's a little bit more, the guys that I see do the best in that because I've got a lot of storage clients, they actually run the business as well. So.
Sure.
They run the freehold and the leasehold of the business. So it's not great for an investor from a lending point of view because it's classed as a specialist asset. So you generally have to put a higher cash deposit in it.
Right.
So the question is, let's say you've got $1 million, you might only be able to buy $2 million worth of storage unit. But if it was one or two industrial properties next door with the same floor area, you could do a 70% loan on that. So you could then leverage up a lot more. So pros and cons.
Yeah. Okay. Nicholas says, with higher yields, are there any commercial properties that are positively geared at max LVR they would recommend if they have equity but not servicing?
Yes, it's a good question. What I'll do is I'll use an example of the last 100% finance deal we did. And It was a property in it was in Mackay. So this is like a nice industrial shed. It was 1.66 million purchase price. So that, and the rent was 120,000 net. So the tenant paid all the outgoings, including management. So we're talking a 7.23% net yield. Now this guy, his interest rate on it with 100% finance was, it was 6.25. And the, I guess what he was clearing after 100% was about 16 grand. About 16,500. So it was positively geared at 100% debt. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, most people put about 30% cash down. So, you know, you were getting about 45 grand positive cash flow in that same circumstance if you're using cash.
Yeah.
Without the cash, you're only going to get 16,000. But it's important to note that rent was growing by about 5,000 a year. It was scheduled, 3.75% increases. So next year, assuming the interest rate's still the same amount, his income's going to be 21K and then 26K after that and 31. So the longer you hold it, the better the story becomes because of the rental increase situation. But you're into the market, and this is the key point. Like if you've got a $1.66 million investment, it's not worth 1.66 mil next year either. It might be worth 1.7, 1.75. So for no money down, it can be an incredibly good decision if you can positively gear it, because you could imagine the numbers of 100% debt on residential. You know, it would be a serious task to cover that debt.
Negatively geared, yeah. So, again, that raises an important point on valuating commercial property. How closely are the yields, the cash flow, linked to the value of a certain commercial property?
It's just one of the valuation methods. So, look, it is close. It's my favourite way of doing a quick valuation on an investment. I look at the rent. It's got to be the market rent too, because sometimes the rent may be inflated or way under. So you've got to come back to the market rent, which is a task in itself, because there's not many sites you can get this data from. You've got to kindly do it manually, unfortunately. But once you know the market rent, you can then go the market cap rate, and then you know that's how you basically will multiply the rent out to get the valuation. But there's so many factors that influence the cap rate year to year. So, you know, the most obvious example is interest rates. They've risen 13 times in the last, you know, since 2022, and that's made the cap rates increase because the cost of money is higher. People need a higher yield to justify the purchase. So we've seen, I'll just use an example. If it was a 6% net yielding investment in 2022, what we've seen the market now is price about a 6.75% yield. So basically people want more rent for the same debt level. Mm. Now, the reason it hasn't gone further than that is just because people are like, they see value in the current yields because they may be coming down. So just because the interest rates have gone up, let's say it goes up 2%, doesn't mean the yields go up 2% as well. There's a lot more that goes into it than that simplistic answer, because confidence in business, short supply of properties, lack of other investment options, the flow of money in the economy, these things all kind of, you know, create demand. And the more demand, the lower the yield can become as well, because people pay more for the same rent and effectively push that yield down, which really just means they're paying more.
Yeah, okay. Generally speaking, would you say the fundamentals between residential and commercial, when you're researching, are the same, you know, like vacancy rates, the population, the infrastructure that's going on around, the economy, the scarcity of something, like all these things that have been known to person in real estate for the last 100 years, is a pretty similar crossover from resi to commercial, or is there something in commercial that's entirely different from a research point of view?
Look, some investments can track similar to residential. Like I find industrial can be often quite similar because a lot of it's in the freehold land value. But again, it's supply demand because, you know, imagine comparing the Sydney CBD office market to Vaucluse. You know, they may be, you know, close to each other geographically, but it's just such a different set of fundamentals because it's got its own supply demand constraints. So the business side of things, with, you know, business demand for leases, what happens with incentives in leases, the economy in general, like the GFC crash compared to a COVID crash is very different for different asset classes as well. You know, so there's a lot of differences. We find the commercial market moves slower as well because there's less transactions. So one indicator of future growth is, you know, assuming everything else is equal, is when the residential market starts growing really quickly, like using Perth as an example, we find that creates a wealth effect. And that wealth effect can get passed on to commercial through confidence, right. Because it does lift the value of the land, the unapproved land values as well. So that can help retail. You know, you can imagine shopping centres in amongst a neighbourhood that's grown 30% in 2 years, it's probably going to be worth more too. So, yeah, there are some ties, but, yeah, it's a bit risky to say that they're similar because there's a massive variable and that's whatever's happening in the business world for that specific asset class.
Sure. So what I'm hearing is Scott says go and buy commercial real estate in Perth right now after the residential boom. Yeah. Okay. Awesome. We're coming to a close, but I wanted to touch on your buyer's agent service at Rethink. And I suppose the difference between, again, BA in residential space versus commercial space. You're transacting much higher numbers. You mentioned the time to maybe acquire a property is longer. Maybe the finance takes longer. What are you seeing as the differences there in that commercial space? And maybe the percentage, how you guys get paid as well, if you can.
Yeah, for sure. So I guess Rethink Investing, we've been around for 10 years now or just under. And what we do is we specialize in commercial. We do residential as well. A lot of people have kind of asked why we're going back more into residential. And I guess one of the main reasons is the commercial market is getting more expensive. So rather than just kind of neglect those with, you know, less than 200K deposits, we actually have seen the residential markets look quite good to invest in. Like, as you would know, John, there's some great opportunities to do well. So we can help them transition into commercial after they've bought a couple of residentials as well. But I think the main thing with commercial investing is it's significantly harder to get right. Residential investing is like, you know, I should say this, but it's quite simple and it's hard to get it wrong if you know the basics. Commercial, even if you think you know a lot, you can get it very wrong. And like we do about 40 commercial transactions per month. So we've done over 4,000 deals, and I still learn things today about like, and there's a head scratcher once a week in this game. I've never seen that. I can't, you know.
Yeah.
So you're always learning, and we've got a big due diligence team, and these guys are valuers, property developers, property analysis type guys, you know, guys like really technical people that put the time into every deal to kind of cross check the numbers and the legalities and the council records. They call tenants up. And, you know, if you're going to buy a commercial property, you want that confidence behind you. Cause I see there's a lot of people that say they're commercial buyer's agents, but, you know, they're just a residential buyer's agency just doing it on the side. That is so risky to do it because the only reason they've gone down that route because it's harder is just to either keep their clients or it's just another revenue stream for the business. But commercial, you've got to be all in, and it takes a large team to get that right. And most of the good deals are off market too. So, you know, if you don't have access to that, the rest doesn't matter.
No.
Yeah. So how we get paid, we charge a percentage fee similar to what a sales agent would get. So we charge 1.9%. And we've charged that for the last 5 years on our fee. So, you know, if we're buying $1 million property, there's a $19,000 fee in it. I always say to our clients, we won't even show you the deal unless we're negotiating that hopefully three or four times over.
Yeah.
And we only get paid if it settles. So, you know, it's a success-based fee. And with that, we do, you know, it's generally a 30 to 50 page due diligence report. And that's where all the time goes. Finding the assets is one part of the time, but just making sure it still stacks up is the other half of the deal.
Yeah, no, that's awesome, Scott. Look, early days, you've had the courage to step into real estate to begin with, and then even more courage to step out of one sector into another, and that being commercial. So, well done on your success up until now. And there's, by the sounds of it, there's much more to come. For those who haven't heard, Scott's a well-renowned author, so you can get a hold of his book. It's called Rethink Property Investing. Also runs a podcast called Inside Commercial Property as well. So he's a busy man. So I appreciate you coming onto the show today, Scott.
No, always a pleasure, Don, and thank you once again.
No worries. Thank you, listeners. Thank you for allowing us into your ears today. If you like what you hear, tell a friend, hit the subscribe button, maybe even give us a review. But yeah, until next time, happy investing.
We acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which we live and work and pay respects to their elders past, present and emerging. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who may listen to this podcast. It's time to get the property you want. If buying your first home or investing in property is something you're interested in, check out John Pidgeon's book, Sort Your Property Out and Build Your Future. John covers the essentials like how to find hotspots and notspots, due diligence, mortgages, tax stuff, grants and schemes, and how to set up your investing timeline. It's the only book you'll need about buying and investing in property. Visit sortyourpropertyout.com to grab your copy. This podcast is for education and entertainment purposes. Any advice is general financial advice only, which does not take into account your objectives, financial situation, or needs. Because of that, you should consider if the advice is appropriate to you and your needs before acting on the information. If you do choose to buy a financial product, read the product disclosure statement, target market determination, and obtain appropriate financial advice tailored to your needs. SIMO Interactive Proprietary Limited, the publisher of the podcast, and Glenn James are authorised representatives of Money Sherpa Proprietary Limited, which holds financial services license 451289.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run futuretools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.